Hello and welcome to The Bike Show here on Resonance FM with me, Jack Thurston. Now, do you remember this?
Here is the start of the drama of today's day to the Tour de France. Again, Pedro Delgado has slipped Stephen Roach on the climb. But remember, at one point he had a minute and a half. And just who is that rider coming up behind? Because that looks like Roach. That looks like Stephen Roach. It's Stephen Roach who's come over the line. He almost caught Pedro Delgado. I don't believe it. What a finish by Stephen Roach. We never knew he was that close. Stephen Roach has risen to the occasion so, so well. He almost caught Pedro Delgado on the line. Surely Stephen Roach is now going to win this Tour de France.
Well, it's hard to believe, but that was 25 years ago this July. It was a truly memorable moment in what was a fabulous year for the fresh-faced, blue-eyed Irish cyclist Stephen Roach, who won not only the Tour de France, but the Giro d'Italia and the World Championship road race, a feat that only he and the great Eddie Merckx have ever completed. Stephen Roach has just written a new autobiography, and he was kind enough to sit down with me and talk about a life in cycling. I began by asking him why he decided to put pen to paper.
This year, being 25 years on, it's like a landmark. You know, you're kind of telling these stories and everyone's asking you questions about the Tour de France and do you remember this and do you remember that, and you know, I'm kind of going on about all these great things that happened and everything else. And so last year, some friends of mine in Hot Chili were saying to me, Stephen, you know, you're telling us all these stories all the time, you know, it would be great to tell them to the world, because we're kind of privileged to be listening here to all these stories, but I mean, you know, you should share it with the world. So we came to Yellow Jersey and said to them, you know, would you be interested in doing a book about it? And we had a good chat with Pete Cousins, who wrote a book with me. And they thought it was a great idea, that there was a lot of good material in there. Initially, you kind of say, well, how am I going to fill 200 pages? What have I got to say about that'll fill 200 pages? Now that it's all done, you say, well, I could have done 200, 400 more pages, because we didn't go with it. You know, too much depth in a lot of things, whereas there are a lot of individuals in the book, whereas we could probably go and see those people now and say, well, what about this episode? What about that? So we've touched on everything in the book and gone into detail in a lot of things, but it was really an amazing and a very emotional kind of journey going back and revisiting all those potholes that we kind of got into and got out of. Write that down through my early days, through the Tour, Giro, and to from the end of my career till now.
So you're on the book tour, and I hope that's going well. For a lot of people of my age, you're one of the first superstars of cycling that we saw on the TV watching bike racing, pretty much the Tour de France. That was all they showed in this country at that point. I guess it's because you're Irish, you speak English. You were really one of the first people that we thought, well, he's someone we can identify with, someone we can kind of grab hold of, take dear to our hearts. What's it like meeting your fans? Were you motivated by the idea of being someone that people would hold in very high esteem and idolise?
Not at all, no. Although I'm probably going to contradict myself in that maybe I wanted my results to be held in memory, because I felt that, you know, you fight hard battles to get results, and you know you do it for yourself, of course. Ultimately you do it because you want to win. But at the end of the day, isn't it great when you hear people talking about Stephen? I remember the stage of the Tour and the Bourbon Bowl in 92, you coming through the fog and winning that last stage. Stephen, we remember you in La Plagne. I remember it was yesterday. Like, talking about the great exploits of my career, which for me were based probably, you know, in my opinion, they would have gone unnoticed in my own eyes, because for me, I was working hard to win. When I won, I basically moved on to the next one. So where people on the street today, even 25 years on, I've been seeing it the last few days doing book signings and what have you, people coming along and remembering vivid memories of my exploits and what I achieved. And yes, it's probably contradictory when I say, yeah, you know, it's not something that kind of bothers me. But at the same time, you're going to say, if people weren't remembering those great episodes and those great achievements, well, you kind of say, well, wasn't a pity, because they were great achievements.
And also, that's the purpose of sport, isn't it? It's not something that's saving the world. It's entertainment. It's a spectacle. It's something that takes us out of our everyday lives. And sporting heroes are central to sport.
Yes, and also I think like back in the 80s when I was at the height of my career and went into Tour de France and everything else, the Irish economy was very bad and Ireland was still a very poor and a very kind of sad place to be. And I think through my different exploits and through the Irish football team at the time, through our boxing, Barry McGuigan, through our running with Sonia Sullivan, Eamon Coughlin, John Tracy, it gave the Irish people something to think about, something to talk about. And basically, I think they could identify themselves with what we were doing and saying, well, like, these guys are Irish. These guys eat spuds and cabbage like us. I mean, why can't we do like them? And I think it actually gave the Irish people a bit of a moral boost as to we are equal to the Europeans. We are living on an island here off of the UK, Britain, but we are an island, but we are human beings. We can be as strong as other continental people. We have our Irish athletes out there doing great things. So why can we not do it in business? So I think that it did give the Irish public a great boost to see their own out there doing it on the world platform.
So let's talk about your early days on the bicycle. What first drew you to riding a bicycle as a kid? Was it just something that all kids do and you just did it too?
Basically, that's what it was. You know, I used to have a paper round and I used to have a trailer on the back of my bike and I used to drag my papers around behind me and deliver my papers to the neighbors' houses and what have you. And my parents rode bikes, but they weren't, like, I never actually saw my parents riding the bikes because they rode bikes before meeting and having a family. Then once they got married, then of course the kids came along straight away. My sister Maria came along practically straight away. So they had no time then for cycling. But they weren't racing cyclists, weren't interested in racing at all. They were interested in the passion of going out and sharing the miles with friends and going out and youth hostelling, enjoying cycling and of course dancing and everything else at the time. So I don't mean discoing like, you know, today, dancing as in ballroom dancing, what have you. Basically, lived in a housing estate where one guy used to ride his bike part of a club and this guy's wife knew I used to have a trailer and a bike where I used to kind of deliver my papers. And she said to me, Stephen, do you like cycling? I said, yes. Well, she said, there's a new club starting up, looking for new members, if you want to go along and join us. So I went along and here I am. So like it was basically by accident in a way that I came into it. Then, of course, you know, I had a extra bit of class and like the title of the book, Born to Ride, basically came from that as well because read the book and you see everything that happened to me, you kind of say, well, you know, it was on the cards, this guy was going to be a cyclist.
Was there a moment that you can think of when you stood out as someone who could be really good at this cycling game?
Well, when I was racing in Ireland as a schoolboy and junior, I had good performances, but I was always being beaten by guys better than me at the time. But then when I went away on the international trips to the UK or to France, I was always the best of the Irish teams, which kind of, you know, gave me a bit of a reputation as to, okay, when the chips are down and the spoils are big, I could actually move to a different level. And also the fact that I always had a steady schooling program. Also, when I started working, I was working, you know, doing a normal job, doing overtime like everybody else. And cycling was like the secondary in my life. Whereas I was competing against guys who were basically part-time workers and nearly full-time cyclists, which kind of gave me advantage that when I did finally decide to stop working and give cycling 100%, I still had a lot more to give. The first real signs of kind of good form was probably my first international schoolboy event in Butlins. I finished second in it. My first time leaving the country, finishing second to an Englishman who is now my brother-in-law, Neil Martin, you know, was a great achievement for a young cyclist going away. And I basically built on it then, and all my other international events like the Isle of Man Cycling Week, I won it, the Harrogate Cycling Festival, I won it as a junior. But the first real signs I showed of international potential would have been the Tour of Ireland, the Milk Ross, as they call it, back in 79, when I was 19 years of age. I think today I'm still the youngest rider to have won the Tour of Ireland Ross. You know, I won it, I won the final time trial, I won a sprint stage on it, and I dominated the international field. So that was probably my first real sign of showing I had international promise.
But to take it to the next level required a move to the continent in those days. Was that a leap in the dark? Did you have reservations about that? Because it meant giving up a job and going with some money in your back pocket to France, to the unknown.
It was, yes, definitely. And, you know, I look back on it now and I say, you know, well done, Stephen. You were very courageous to do that, because I was only 19 years of age and never been away for any more than a weekend. And here I am going on this adventure, not knowing where it was going to bring me. But I was luckily picked up by a French coach who saw me training here with the Irish national team and said, Stephen, you want to go to the Olympics, you want to do a good result, you got to go and ride in a French club closer to the international scene, where I was commuting all the time between Ireland and UK, Ireland and France for international races. You can't perform at your best. So my job gave me 6 months leave of absence and gave me a little bit of a handshake going away. The local people in Dundrum also had a whip around and got me £500 to send him on my way. And then basically I, you know, off I went. But I was going away and, you know, some people around me were saying and thinking that, well, like, we saw Sean Kelly going abroad and doing relatively well. But then Sean Kelly was a hard man. He's from the country. Whereas Stephen's from the city, so he's a dub. Whereas the city folk aren't very hard. So they were basically kind of making illusions that I would kind of go over to France and go once around the Eiffel Tower and come home again. So that was one thing in my mind when I was going away, that was I'm going to disappoint these people. I'm going to stay away. Doesn't matter what happens, I'm gone for a year and I'm not coming back. I went away and luckily enough I got results relatively quickly in the amateur ranks.
And your first pro season was amazing success. That must have given you a lot of confidence and self-belief going forward.
It did, and probably gave me, you know, too much confidence, because in 82 I fell flat on my face. Like, I was 21 years of age, won Paris-Nice, and I still am the youngest rider to have won Paris-Nice even today. I won 9 races that first year. I won it through Corsica as well. And of course everybody was saying, well, this Irish guy now is going to replace Bernahino. He's got everything it takes. He climbs well, he time trials well. So of course you start believing what you read in the papers. And you're invited then, because you're a new star, you've won all these different events, you've won all these different trophies, and you're invited to all these different receptions during the off-season. And I found myself basically on the back door of a new season, and I hadn't really recovered from the first season. So I spent 82 basically picking up the pieces, and had a kind of a down 82, no victories. Good places, okay, but no victories. But then I kind of, because I didn't have a good season, I was left alone in 82. And I came back and another good season then in 83.
The year 1987 is the year that everyone remembers about your career, the Triple Crown. The way you tell the story, you come across as a rider who really knew how to take his chances when they came along.
I was very, very lucky that I had a good head, that I was very good tactically and very good at looking and analysing the situation. I was an opportunist as well. I wasn't just kind of happy to say, okay, I'm second here overall on GC, let's wait and see what happens and maybe he might fall off and I might win. I was there kind of second overall on GC, trying to find a way to beat the other guy, and scheming and plotting ways of maybe, you know, catching him out, and whether it be in a crosswind, whether it be on descent, whether it be on a climb, you know, all the time kind of trying to find a way of getting the better of this guy that's ahead of me.
You talk about that ruthless side and that scheming, calculating side. But in the Giro, it's against your own team leader.
You know, theoretically, when you put it down on paper, that was super tactical manoeuvre, because here I was getting a Carrera jersey up in front, which meant the Carrera team hadn't got to defend behind. So, I mean, if you talk about strategy, that was ideal strategy. I did a good thing by going in the front. I was doing my team a favour. Well, okay. Maybe it wasn't. I was scheming, yes. It was an attack, yes. You must not forget that I've been riding in the pink jersey for the first few days and Vizzantini wasn't riding for me. Then when Vizzantini got the jersey and journalists were saying to him, well, Roberto, now you have the jersey, road's going to work for you. And Roberto turned to the journalist and said, ah, yes, road's going to work for me now. And the journalist said, well, you're going to work for him and pay back in the Tour de France. And Roberto said, oh, no, during the Tour, I'm going on holidays. So I'm saying, well, here he is now kind of telling me blatantly to my face that I'm going to ride for him, where he has never ridden for me, first of all. And number two, there's never going to be a payback because he's going to go on holidays while I'm going to ride a Tour de France. So basically, he cut our ties there and then. So, you know, I still say I didn't attack him. I just went down the hill faster than him.
So you must have had a lot of willpower to go on, because you were getting some horrendous abuse on the road from the the Tifosi, the Italian fans. You'd gone against their man, and you were this Irish guy coming in, taking their race from their man. The willpower to carry on through that must have been something that you surprised yourself with.
Definitely. Like, if you were to sit down here with me and say, Stephen, you're going to a Tour of Italy, here's a scenario, and you describe everything that happened to me in the Giro of 87, I would say, no, that's not for me. I wouldn't entertain that. I'd be out of there. Where, in fact, when I was in the middle of it all, people were shouting at me, Roach Bastardo, Roach Go Home, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they were branding, like, you know, big, you know, banners with horrible stuff written on it. And then in the climbs, they were taking rice in the mouth, and as I was going past, taking red wine and spitting it all at me as I was going past, and had to have police protection at the finish line to be taken to my hotel. My bike was basically quarantined after the finish and made sure no one touched it until the next morning. My food was prepared for me by my masseur because we were afraid of people trying to poison me. It got very, very rough, you know. So if you were kind of telling me this is going to happen, I'd say I wouldn't tolerate it at all. I'd be out of there. Where, in fact, here was I in the middle of the situation. I'm saying to the Italian fans and the Italian press, do what you want, say what you want, I'm staying. All during my career and during my life, there's always been kind of points where I've kind of shown an kind of incredible willpower or incredible kind of determination to get out of situations. I was exposed to an awful lot of aggression by the Italian people, Italian press, and I came up trumps against it all. And I came out and won the stage, or second the stage to Pila, and I won the stage, the time trial into San Marino, and I basically dominated at the end of the Giro. So the Italian tifosi then basically came around to my side then, and they acknowledged what I had done. And the Pope then, of course, invited me back a few months later for my confession. and we wiped the slate clean, and I gave him a yellow jersey.
18 days later, having won the Giro d'Italia, you're going for the Tour de France, which is an interesting tour because it was Jacques Gaudet's final tour. He'd been running the tour for 50 years or somewhat. It was a super long tour, the last of the super long 4,000 kilometre plus tours, a real tour of endurance. And there were a number of contenders.
The fact that I'd have won the Giro made me very comfortable compared to the other 10 or so guys that were capable of winning, meaning that every time a break went away, every time something happened, they would look across to me and say, well, Stephen, are you going to ride? I say, well, I've won my tour. So I've won my Giro. So like my contract is fulfilled this year, so I haven't got to win this one. So it gave me a lot of leeway room to play around with. And like it was very good at strategy. And it you know, I really kind of, I developed an art for it, really.
The story of the tour really does show clearly your race craft. You study the race book very carefully, every different aspect of the course of each stage. You choose your gearing on the bicycle very carefully. You're aware of the other riders and their strengths and weaknesses, the things that they have to get out of the race that you can use to your own advantage. And you're cutting deals with other riders and other teams that you might need. As you said, you were not on a team with strong climbers.
There is an awful lot more to it than meets the eye, of course. It's about man and machine, but it's also the mental side of it as well. I got a great kick out of being able to kind of thinking and feeling and one step ahead of the other guys. I was good at analysing a situation, knowing, respecting and analysing my opponents. Then I was also good at going out and looking at an itinerary and basically breaking it down into sections. Like in time trialling, I could go out and could basically absorb everything, where I'd be kind of say, okay, I'm going to take off here, I'm going to up a gear here, down a gear there. Those wheels are good for here, but those wheels are better, so I'm going to use this bike. I'd be kind of sitting down, composing, like my bike, my gearing and everything else, composing my itinerary as to where I can afford to accelerate, where I can afford to lose a second, because I'm going to gain 2 seconds over here. And that was one of my strong points, which I think came through very strongly in the 87 Tour, but like it was the longest tour, was 26 days, 4,500 kilometres, 4,200 kilometres, I think it was. But when the tour was announced, I would have taken out the tour, put it down on a table, and I said, okay, which days in here must I be present? Because you cannot race like to win every day for 26 days. So I would have broken up into, say, 6 days. One day would have been the prologue, because I feel I have to kind of show everybody I'm here. So be careful, I'm here. And then you got the first team time trial, of course. Everyone has to be collective, and it's good to win a strong team time trial because you're showing everybody else you got a strong team. Then the next event, important for me, would have been the time trial in Futuroscope, which I won, because right against the clock, you can lose a tour, as Laurent Fignon found out later on. Then after that, then my fourth major stage would be the first mountain top finish, so where you have to be performant as well. So, and I felt that once you get to the first stage in the mountains, then I sit back and analyse what's going on, who's still in competition with me for the yellow jersey, and then kind of invent plans then for the next bit, you know. So and that's actually how it worked. Like I finished third in the prologue. We Carrera won the team time trial. I won the time trial in Futuroscope, and the idea was between those different stages, I was basically to stay undercover and try not to miss out on any of the bad breaks or the stupid breaks, you know. And I only missed that once, was in the stage into Blaenau, I think it was. It was lashing rain, it was floods of water on the road. And for one split second, I got soft. I said, I'm going to put a raincoat on. And I pulled out of the line to move back to get a raincoat from the car. And Fignon and Mutte saw me moving back. They went to the front and formed what we call an echelon, like kind of in the crosswinds. And it took off with a group of 40 people. So, which meant that I lost, 30, 40 seconds. So,
Was that a dishonourable thing for them to have done? Because you said, well, I wouldn't attack Fignon when he's had a puncture. And they attack you when you're putting your raincoat on.
No, a puncture is something which happens in the race, which is unlucky. Going to put a raincoat is just being fragile. It's being soft. You know, those are the super things about the riders like Fignon, Kelly, Delgado. They watched and waited for an opportunity, as I did in Italy, in the Tour of Italy, waited for an opportunity. And these boys saw an opportunity to get rid of Roach, and they took it. And I fair play to them. Like, you know, I think that we can just flash into the cycling of today. I think, unfortunately, we forget about that kind of stuff, and we're trying to be too gentlemanish. You know, we kind of, oh, please take my wheel. Oh, please. Oh, you have a chain problem. Please, I'll wait for you. You know, you got to get on with it, and things happen in bike races, and they've always happened in bike races. The only reason I would basically back off is if there's a major crash. You know, other than that, I think there's no, you have to get on with the racing and maintain racing as it's been, been made popular for us. That it's a passion, it's the legend, it's the epic rides we see, and we can only have that if we have kind of incidents happening every day.
Well, it came down to a tussle in the mountains with Pedro Delgado, and the stage to La Plagna is the one that's etched into many people's memories with that fantastic commentary by Phil Liggett. And at that time, there weren't race radios for the riders. There were fewer TV cameras. You were able to take advantage of that in minimizing the deficit that you had to Delgado, and he didn't know that you were coming up on him. That's a move that some people say was, you know, what helped you win the Tour. Do you think that kind of move isn't possible today because of the TVs everywhere and the radios?
Definitely couldn't happen today because of the race radios and television. Everyone knows where everybody is. I was really going on a phenomenon of kind of surprise. I thought, well, Legato would know at 5K to go, a minute and a half down. So he basically thinks, well, okay, the Tour is won, as all the journalists did too. But the last final 5K, if I give it everything, I can come back very quickly at him. Maybe get it down to around 30 seconds, maybe on the finish line. But I knew that no matter what the outcome was, that the smaller the gap was on the finish line, the better it was for me and the more chance I would have of beating him in the time trial in Dijon. But if I'd known that I was closing so fast on him, I may have backed off and said, okay, well, I'm 35 seconds down or 40 seconds down. I can still beat him in the time trial in Dijon, so maybe I can back off. But because I didn't know where he was, I buried myself right to the end. And it was only when I came around the final corner and I saw the kind of vague image of Pedro in front of me, I didn't even realise then what was going on. I just saw this figure. It didn't really register with me. I was in another land, another world. And, of course, I collapsed then on the finish line. My mechanic was there beside me and he says, Stephen, move your legs in because the cars are coming close to you. And then I realised how bad it was because I couldn't move any of my limbs at all. I couldn't move anything. And the doctor was taking my arms up to put the tinfoil or the special kind of a recovery blanket over me to keep me warm. The doctor was saying to me, Stephen, if you can hear us, blink your eyes but I couldn't move. So I was blinking my eyes. They're putting oxygen into me.
So you won the Tour and finished the amazing season with the World Championships, but you never really returned to those serious heights for the rest of your career. What was your role during that time after you'd achieved the Triple Crown in the peloton? Were you the boss? Was that a role that you took on?
In the peloton today, in the media, they go on with the boss, you know, but in my opinion, there was never really a boss, really. In the times you have, like Bernahino, for example, he would dictate certain days, like, you know, maybe not dictate, but he dictated respect. And where people just wouldn't do anything at all because they know that Hino would give out to them. Whereas I think in my generation, the likes of myself, Laurent Fignon, are probably the last of the real bosses because we basically, I was able to kind of stand out and say, this is how it's done. And people then respected it then. And Fignon the very same. And since then, everyone lets everybody do everything now. And there's nobody really there willing to stand up. Jalabert was probably one of the last guys maybe to stand up and say, listen guys, this is what's doing, you know. The guys today, they're good in their own way. They're super champions in their own way. But as regards boss, they haven't got the respect of each other.
You don't think Lance Armstrong took that role on?
Yeah. Armstrong had the respect, yeah. But Armstrong had the respect, but he was a bit he was despised by a lot of people because he was of his kind of his showmanship, because of his kind of the security all around him, and everybody felt that Armstrong got a better deal than anybody else because he was his bus was always parked next to the signing on, where everybody else was kind of way down the road, whereas Armstrong always had a little bit of a favour from everybody.
But so, you were able to dictate to the peloton, say this is what we want today, this is what we don't want today.
I won't say dictate, but like what I'm saying, for example, is when we had an issue with helmets back in 88, 89, and of course everyone talks about it, but I was the one who had to talk to Heinz Verbruggen of the UCI in headquarters that we didn't want to wear helmets, that you know, my thing at the time was, well, like, it's okay for you guys making all these rules, making it compulsory that we ride helmets when you guys are back there in your air-conditioned offices in Lausanne dictating the rules. Like, come down here and ride one of these climbs with a hard shell helmet. Like, the hard shell helmets in those days were like, you know, like full plastic and no air ventilation at all. So it was very, very hard to wear them. Like, here we are now, like 25 years on, I wouldn't go out on a bike without a helmet. I wouldn't let my sons on a bike without a helmet. I wouldn't let anybody out on a bike without a helmet. So, like, when you are young, you are fairly kind of, you are fairly impulsive, and you do kind of, you don't always see the right in what people in the UCI and everybody else are trying to impose on the cyclists, you know. But like, for example, I'm talking now with the UCI about a lot of things, but amongst them we're talking about they're zipping up the jerseys. Like, they find it quite normal that it should be their jersey should be opened right down and flapping in the winds, you know. Whereas I'm saying is, well, if you're a sponsor and all I can see is half your name on a jersey because the jersey's open, it's not very good for sponsorship. And in cycling at the moment, where we are trying to kind of upgrade the image of cycling and attract bigger sponsors into the game, if they can see all they get is half their name on a jersey because the jersey is always open, well, they might change sports maybe. You know, people are saying now, well, that I'm a little out of date maybe. But at the same time, it's something I strongly believe in. And I think that the riders today, there are some riders that are opposing it today, saying road to zip up. I think maybe in 10 years' time, they will sit back down and see the importance. If they're really passionate about the whole thing, cyclists today, look at themselves. They don't look down the road, 25 years down the road, as I didn't when I was their age. So maybe in 20 years' time, they look back and say, well, like, you know, Roach, when he was saying there, wasn't that bad after all.
I don't think that a company like T-Mobile pulled out from its sponsorship of cycling because it was concerned about the jerseys being zipped up or down. I think they pulled that their money out because cycling was tarnished with doping. The end of your career coincided with the rise of a new era in doping. Doping's always been in cycling since the earliest days, through the great champions, Coppi, Anquetil, Moser, you name them. Did you notice the rise of this new doping in the early 90s around you? And was that part of your decision to retire at a relatively young age of 33 from the sport?
No, it wasn't at all the reason for my retirement. And I think that getting back to the reasons as to why Telecom might have pulled out of cycling, like why did the German television stop filming cycling? They said it was for doping, but you know, are you telling me there's no doping in any other sports? And are you telling me that in the German football there's no doping? You know, I think it's a matter of cycling was an easy kill for many people. And I think that I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but I think unfortunately other richer sports are getting away with a lot more than what's happening in cycling, but we don't touch them because it's too rich. But I would never say the guy beat me because he was doping or whatever. You know, I kind of have faith in the controls, even though it's been proven that the controls maybe weren't all as foolproof as they seem to be. You know, it's very easy to say, looking back now, with everything we know that has come transpired in the 90s, it's very easy to say now that, yes, I remember back in the certain riders doing great performances back in the early 90s. You can say, well, like, those guys definitely must have been taking something because now we know what was going on, you know. You know, it doesn't change anything. The history is there. Those races never be won by anybody else but those people. So to answer your question directly, yes, you know, it's easy to say now in hindsight, but some of the performance we've seen in the early 90s was, I'm sure, down to people modifying their biological preparation.
I mean, we know that for sure. It's not a matter of conjecture. Bjarne Riis has just written a book where he's talked about it. The whole of his career was about EPO use and other things, testosterone, cortisone.
I haven't read Bjarne Riis's book, but I remember it when him making the statement about his time at T-Mobile. So I remember him saying he was taking EPO and everything else. But, you know, I think that Bjarne Riis was a good rider, even despite, you know, what he might have been taking, you know. You see Armstrong, you see Riis, you see the whole thing. And, you know, I have a little bit of difficulty in the guys writing the books like this, you know, because I think it's great, it's nice. But, you know, what are they doing for cycling? You know, are they really kind of doing, by coming out, are they doing cycling a favour or are they doing themselves a favour?
There's another point of view which says it was so endemic, it perhaps still is endemic, that nothing less than a spring clean, by which I mean people coming forward and telling their experiences of their own doping or the doping that was going on around them, like David Miller did, only that kind of let's be open about this and let's really reinvent our sport for the first time, because we've had this chemical addition to our sport since the very, very beginning, and we want to have a sport where we don't have this, but we're going to have to go through a process of truth and reconciliation, whatever you want to call it, where people come out and say that. And that's not going to happen when the big figures in the sport are still a bit ambivalent about this truth coming out. And it's not going to happen when those that do come out and talk about their experiences are vilified, criticized, told that they're spitting in the soup or whatever.
Like, everybody out there today in the streets thinks that all cyclists were taking doping. So not a one thing you can say that'll change their mind. So it's not by going out and saying, well, I took a little bit here, a little bit there, took nothing. People will always believe that, well, in cycling, doping is rampant and they all take it. So what I'm saying is that I don't think it changes anything in the mind of people other than people say, well, now we know what he took.
Isn't the thing that exactly is going to change their minds about cycling the thing that they've been denied, which is the truth? And the truth is what is needed here.
I totally agree with that. I would like to see these people going to the federation, UCI, their own federation, going to the police, going to the customs, going to the all the people involved with illegal traffic, drug traffic and everything else, and say, listen, guys, I'm a cyclist. In my sport, this is what's going around. These are the guys that are selling it. This is how I buy it. This is how I can mask it up and give the whole thing. Then they can say they're doing something for the sport. They can say they're okay, I'm not saying they're not doing anything by coming out with everything in the books, but at the same time, I think that it would speed up the whole process of getting to the bottom of things. Why should the UCI and different federations spend millions of euros developing anti-doping techniques and still be one lap behind the real cheats. And we all know that doping will always be there to some extent. Maybe it's all gone now, but there'll always be some guys doing it. And when you're in there, you see what's going on, I'm sure. If something new is coming on, we see riders doing great performances even now, and there's some suspicion around certain riders, certain performers. Like, why not go ahead now and tell the people that this is going on in our sport, rather than keeping it for ourselves until somebody's caught and someone writing a book about it and saying, oh, yeah, I'm sorry, I was taking something and whatever.
But you must have been aware of what was going on when you were a rider. You're not a naive guy. You say you're a naive guy in the book, but that doesn't match everything else.
No, when I said naive, you know, what I mean is I was naive to what was going on towards the 90s. Like, you see things going on, for example, we all knew in the 80s there was some amphetamines going around, like there was maybe some cortisone and some steroids. That was probably the as far as it went back in the, as far as my knowledge, in the 80s. Then the EPO came in, and probably towards the end of my career, you hear about different things going around. You hear about EPO. You don't know a lot about it, but you hear about it. Then you hear about how it's actually administered and everything else, and how different guys can increase their performances, and maybe that performance is probably related to the EPO, but it probably doesn't mean it is. You think you know, or you feel, well, some guys are taking this EPO stuff forever, you know? But what I'm saying I was naive was I didn't really realize how bad it was, because it was only like a couple of years like after I'd retired and everything started coming out that I started to realize, gee, you know, that's it's what's going on here is absolutely unbelievable.
And then you find samples of your own blood with EPO in it in an Italian university laboratory that's at the center of a conspiracy of athletic doping of cycling and other sports as well. I mean, that must have come as a shock.
But there's no blood found with my name on it.
No, your blood, not with your name on it, but your blood in DNA terms.
There was blood found related to some code names, and people assumed that my name was associated with these code names. But it's only an assumption as well. It was very unfortunate that that the journalists kind of jump onto this and bring it forward. I'm basically guilty because of association with the Carrera team, because the Carrera team were under investigation amongst this doctor in Italy. There was records found on his computer relating back to some of the riders who all had code names, and they had associated what they call a Rocky or Roncati or a name like that, which they thought that must be Roach. But who said it was Roach?
You're a senior rider on the Carrera team, winner of the Triple Crown. Wouldn't you have known that this was going on? I mean, you're admitting that the Carrera team was involved in the doping, and you're saying that you were one of the riders that wasn't involved in that. But you would have known about it, right? You would have known that they would have come to you and said, hey, Stephen, there's this new stuff. We've got these doctors in the university who are helping us with it. Do you want some? It wouldn't have gone on behind your back, would it?
Well, in those days, you didn't know what was going on next door. And
it's not next door, it's in your own team.
Well, it's next door because no one knew what was going on. Those days, nobody spoke about what they were doing. And you must remember, like, I was at the end of my career. The likes of the Bontempis, Capuccis, and these guys, they were all kind of up and coming in their career. So me, I was back with Carrera, basically, to give Claudio Capucci a hand, try and get to the top, try and coach him, try and keep him calm. My role in Carrera in 92, 93 wasn't there to win race. It was there basically to kind of help the guys. So I was on a different agenda basically than everybody else. Like I was doing, we used to always do these blood tests with the team. And I give my blood the same as everybody else. I get my results back. You're low on vitamin B, low on iron, whatever. So I'd know myself then I got to take some vitamin B, got to take some iron, whatever. That was as far as it went, as far as I was concerned. But apparently the blood was being used, my blood and the other guys' bloods were being used for tests, but I'm not aware of that. For me, there's nothing illegal about it, so no one ever told me about it. I found out about it when this thing all blew up in 2000, like 7 years after my career ended. Like,
I'm not sure that it's the doping per se that is at the heart of the problem of trust. I think it's the lying, the concealment. And if you look at riders like Fausto Coppi, Jacques Anquetil, legendary figures, were pretty open about what they were doing. It's the riders who say one thing and then did another thing. And that's why I'm labouring the point about the time is now to be open about the past. And unless you can be truthful about the past, then we can have no confidence of what's going on in the present and the future is going to be any more truthful than what has been going on in the recent past.
I never heard any, you know, stories about like Anquetil and Kobe coming out and saying that they took stuff. We read about it in the papers afterwards, okay, but same as what's happening today. You know, so writers are coming out today and writing books about what they did. That's great. If they feel that they need to do it, let them do it.
But wouldn't you encourage them to do it?
Well, I mean, you got to balance it, you know.
Like balance it with what? Balance truth with lies? Balance transparency with opacity?
No. I think that, like, why was our generation there that were taking EPO and everything else? The generation of the 90s took a lot of EPO because back in the 80s, you had young kids who were 15, 16, 17 years of age, schoolboys and juniors, and they're having sore legs on the race on Sunday. Daddy's would go to the doctor and local GP and say, listen, doc, my son is riding the race last weekend. He's got sore legs. Can you have something? Can you give him something for his sore legs? The GP would give him some medication. Could be an aspirin today. Tomorrow could be caffeine. Then it's amphetamine. Then it's EPO. So you get young riders that are 18, 19 years of age already on performance-enhancing drugs, even though they don't really recognize as being performance-enhancing drugs. And they get on then to interprofessional cycling. They cannot do without it because all they've ever... The results have just come from DPO. Then you find themselves professional for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years and you get the Festina affair, like back in the late 90s. So then you got a generation to wipe out then before you actually get back to cleanliness again, because the young kids of today, they're being so tightly monitored and GPs don't give out EPO anymore. There's been so many people caught. Things have become so strict now that the young kids have to do it all on courage now. So I think that the young kids of the late 80s and that made professionals in the 90s were lazy people, that they used performance enhancing drugs to kind of take shortcuts in training, and once they got into it then they couldn't do without it. So, you know, it was a culture thing as well, the same as you might get kind of in the nightclubs today, you have something, yesterday is something else, and in 10 years time you'll have something else. The same as, you know, in society there are also drugs to help you get up in the morning and go to bed at night. And I mean, it was a kind of a thing that happened in cycling for a generation.
Were you not concerned about your own son entering into that world?
If parents had been saying to their kids when they were back in the late 80s, you've got sore legs because you aren't training enough, you've got sore legs because you aren't getting enough sleep, you've got sore legs because you're doing too much running around, that taking aspirin or caffeine or whatever won't help you, that would have been doing the kids good. So I've always told my kids, cheating in life doesn't get you anywhere, that it always comes back to haunt you. So to be very careful what you do. If you look at the other guys and say these guys are cheating, you got to cheat to beat them, you'll never beat them in the end. So you got to stay clean and respect yourself, respect where you've come from, respect your family, and you'll get on with it. The important thing is you can go to bed at night time and sleep knowing that tomorrow morning you can wake up and look at yourself in the mirror, and what you see in the mirror is what you really are.
And so your approach to it was very much wanting to play by the rules.
Definitely play by the rules. And for me, it was always cheating. You know, if you read in my book, you will see even like, you know, one time Bernard Tevenet came behind me in the car and was attacking Robert Miller going up a climb. And I was ahead, and Tevenet came up to me in the car and he was shouting at me, come on, Stephen, Miller's coming back at you. And he put his hand out to put on my saddle. And the second I felt his hand on my saddle, I swiped out my arm. I hit him straight in the face because I could never, ever, ever. For me, the sticky bottle, as you call it, where cyclists get a bottle from a car and they're kind of get a slight little bit of advantage, I was getting a mechanical incident on my bike. I couldn't tolerate the mechanic pushing my bike for so long because it was cheating. Like, I was always somebody that could never tolerate cheating or of any kind. And I tried to kind of install that in Nicholas now as well. Where does doping begin and end? Where does cheating begin and end?
I mean, that's an interesting question, because you were happy to inject yourself with vitamins and you had a lot of cortisone for your knee. But cortisone is also something which can have a wider impact on the body. Bernard Thévenet cites cortisone as being part of his regimen for winning the Tour in 75 and 77. How did you make those decisions? Because, you know, it's not a question of being caught, because there was no test for it in those days. How did you chart that line? That fine line, that invisible line, because in many ways it was an invisible line, because some things weren't banned, yet they were clearly something that would work. How did you make those decisions?
Obviously, you don't, you've researched a lot of stuff, but you haven't researched that side of it. Like the cortisone I got on my knee was mesotherapy, like micro whatever, in under the kneecap to help the pain as anybody gets. Whereas when you're talking about cyclists taking cortisone for preparation, it's a whole different program. So it's not a question of what you do to put under the radar. You know, it's a matter of the whole strategy is totally different. Whereas you can never ever associate me getting a couple of kind of.
I'm not making any accusation here. What I'm saying is, you're making decisions about what to take and what not to take. There are things that work but haven't yet been banned. There are things that are banned but yet can't be tested for. How do you chart your way through that with your own moral compass?
Well, I'm not an expert in a lot of that stuff, but for example, you're giving, at the start of the year, you're giving a list of what's on the banned list and you abide by that. It's not a question of what is detectable, not detectable. That's for your own morale to come to terms with later on, and you don't play around with it.
I would like to ask about the US anti-doping agency's case that has begun against US Postal, a number of people named, including Lance Armstrong. Do you think it's good that 10 or more riders that have testified and given witness statements about Lance Armstrong's alleged performance-enhancing drug taking, do you think it's good that they've done that?
Well, they had to do it. They were under oath. Like if they were asked before about it and they all ignored it. But then they're asked to swear under oath. Well, you can't really lie, can you? So it was going to bring cycling forward. Let it be done. But I just kind of say, well, like, you know, at some stage, we have to move on from the Lance Armstrong affair. Be it one way or the other. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not clear it or whatever. I'm just saying at some stage, like, we've come at the every year before the Tour de France, unfortunately, we throw out some new story about Armstrong or someone writes a new book. And here we are throwing everything back on the fire again. We have a Super Tour de France now coming up, but for the first time in many, many years, we have an English guy looking to win the yellow jersey and capable of winning the yellow jersey. We have Cavendish out there capable of winning the green jersey. Like, it's a dream for cycling, and it's very refreshing to see these young guys coming up. So unfortunately, the talent that these guys have and the good they're doing for the sport today, bringing up these other affairs, it's unfortunate for these guys. I agree they have to be dealt with, has to be done, but the sooner the thing is sorted out and done and dusted, I think it's the better is for everybody.
But if we end up with this year seeing Ryder Heiserdahl from the Garmin team winning the Giro d'Italia and, say, Bradley Wiggins from the Sky team winning the Tour, we're going to have two champions of Grand Tours from teams that have made very strong statements about being part of this new future of clean sport, and that's got to be a good thing.
Well, I'm glad we're finishing off on a good note, because I think it's very important to highlight what's going on with the teams and what they are doing to fight against doping. I think that on the outside, it's not as well enough known how much things is going on. We always write about the negative side of things when someone's caught positive or the Armstrong affair, but we don't write enough about the great lengths that teams themselves are going to. The money is costing teams to fight against doping. The money is costing to develop new techniques, and the cycling body alone is spending, I don't know how much, maybe it's nearly two-thirds or almost over half their budget on doping prevention, whereas that money was shared between other sports, the whole team would go an awful lot faster and cycling would have a lot more money to spend for developing cycling.
So who's going to win the Tour?
I think Wiggins would be a fair man to put the money on, but it's going to be a brilliant Tour, I think, because it's wide open.
I was in conversation with Stephen Roach, and his book, Born to Ride, is published by Yellow Jersey Press and is out now. That's all from The Bike Show this week. Don't forget about Velonotte this coming Saturday night, the 23rd of June. It's a nighttime architectural bike ride around the City of London and the East End with a live soundtrack broadcast right here on Resonance FM. So take your FM radio with you. There's more information about it on The Bike Show website and on the website of the London Festival of Architecture. Until then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Out on the Champs-Élysées, I knew it would not be long before I heard the whir of wheels and saw the peloton. Tout le monde went, ooh la la, bien, c'est magnifique. When a man with a strange accent pushed through the crowd to speak. Get out of that saddle, Steven! Get out of that saddle, son!
dancing out on me in the figure, drinking pints of drams and more. He said, you gave us Maestro D, more damp and cool the sack. And now I'm pleased to tell you, we can give you two wars back. You gave us wars like champagne, citron and even gauche. Now French has two new wars for great, the wars are Stephen Rhodes. Get out of that saddle, Stephen! Get out of that saddle, son! Keep the peasants turning, and you have the damn thing won! Now worry about Delgado, Herrera or Fignon. Tonight I'll be down to Pigat, take a pint to Creme de Monde. And halfway up the cold old beast, under the midday sun, the gradient was rising, the sweat began to run. The cyclists were gasping, the air was getting thin. And as the crowd were roaring, a voice came through the din. Get out of that saddle, Stephen! Get out of that saddle, son! 8,000 feet by backside, did get worse around Dundrum. There's only another 1,000 miles to Paris, that's not fair. You're only gasping for oxygen, I'm gasping for a jar.